fields on this 10-day trip. For more information, call 217-333-7300 or visit will.illinois.edu/willtravel.
I'm Michelle Martin, and this is Tell Me More from NPR News. We're going to start today with some big news in the world of education. The Department of Education recently announced that transgender students are protected under Title IX. That's a regulation to protect people from discrimination based on sex in educational programs and institutions that receive federal financial aid. Now, advocates for transgender students are praising the decision, while others, as you might imagine, are calling it a step too far to protect a very small group of people. We wanted to hear more about this discussion, so we've called upon two people who we've relied upon in the past to help us understand these issues from their different perspectives. Mara Kiesling is Executive Director of the National Center for Transgender Equality. That's a policy advocacy group based in Washington, D.C. Welcome back.
Thanks for having me.
Gail Trotter is an attorney, a columnist, and senior fellow at the Independent Women's Forum. That's a conservative-leaning policy and research group. Welcome back to you as well.
Thank you for having me.
So, Mara, let me start with you. You were telling us that advocates who've been working in this area are very excited about this. Tell me why you think this is significant and why you think it's necessary.
Well, it's been really clear for a long time that it's necessary that schools protect students from discrimination and from bullying and from sexual assault. And what the sexual assault guidance that was issued last week says is that the Department of Education agrees that Title IX prohibitions against sex discrimination includes discrimination against students because they are transgender. And that just sort of makes sense.
What would happen now, or what do you feel this does that allows to happen that did not happen before?
Sure. It's a really helpful thing for school districts. They now are being told very clearly that it is against the law to not protect transgender students. They have to allow transgender students full access to schools just like they allow anybody else. And this helps clarify what that means for the school districts so they don't run afoul of the law, so they don't waste precious resources fighting lawsuits.
Gail, you are skeptical of this. You were telling us that you think it's a very blunt instrument for dealing with a problem with a very small population of people. Tell us more about your perspective on this.
This was guidance offered by the Department of Education, avoiding having a change to this law, which would include gender identification, instead of going through the democratic process, vetting it, having Congress have an open and public debate, and having the president choose to sign it or not. It also hasn't gone through the court process. So I think that's very important. Now, it's not part of the law, but it has a chilling effect on schools because they don't want to be investigated by the feds. So they are going to change their behavior based on this guideline.
Well, that's obviously the point. I mean, for people to change their behavior. But my question to you is, is your objection to the substance or is your objection to the process? I mean, is your argument that, well, tell me a little bit more about that. So on the substance of it, I mean, are you suggesting that transgender students should be discriminated against?
Definitely not. But the whole purpose behind the passage of Title IX was to create full participation for the underrepresented sex. And we all know that that's women. And when you look at the studies that show how important sports are to women gaining leadership positions and having the ability to assert themselves in the workplace, we understand that it's critically important for women to have those opportunities. So the idea behind Title IX was to allow full participation by women. This guidance offered by the Department of Education is going in the opposite direction. It's going to reduce opportunities for women to participate in sports in schools.
So tell me then again in your objection on the process question.
Yes, we talk frequently about culture wars and why can't people accept the fact that our society has changed and our culture has changed. And part of it is because these edicts come down. They're not part of the political process that have not been debated. And people feel like they are left out of the debate. So for 42 years, the law has meant one thing. It meant that sex distinctions are important, and we can recognize that. And in these two particular areas, that this guidance was released on sexual violence, sexual assault, and female participation in athletics. So in those two areas for 42 years, gender identification was not part of that. Well, so it's completely contradictory to the entire language of the law, and it also does not allow the American people who have differing views on this to have input in this process.
it would seem to me that at least some of the transgender students are girls, or at least they identify as women. So it seems to me that they would be covered under your kind of rubric. But let me ask Marta to address those two questions that you just raised. And if you're just joining us, we're talking about the Department of Education's recent announcement that transgender students are protected under Title IX. That's a regulation that bans sex discrimination in institutions and educational programs that receive federal financial aid. So I think I'm kind of interested in the process question first, if you don't mind, because I think her argument is that this is the kind of thing that creates a backlash, is that it doesn't give people a chance to get used to the idea, to discuss the idea, and it actually impedes acceptance. So if you don't mind taking that argument first.
Sure, absolutely. Well, the process question is always brought up by the people who oppose the policy. The process works the same way in both directions, depending on who's in charge, and that's true. And when people do something I don't like, and the process is what it used to be, it can bother me, but it's still the process. Everything that was done according to the law. I just don't believe the process question is important, particularly because...
Well, but wait a minute, Mara, let me push you on that, because, well, of course it's brought up by the people who don't like it, because in part what they're saying is, give me a minute to get used to this, or let me think about it, or let me figure out how this works in my life. And so, well, sure. I think that's her point, is that it creates more anger among the people who don't like it.
Well, I think that's right, except that when the pendulum swings the other way and the exact same process is being used for things that other people like, they won't complain about the process. Yeah, the process is clearly very important. But in this case, remember, we're talking about sexual assault and sexual violence largely. And that they would say, and this includes transgender people, they have to be protected too. Nobody opposes that. I mean, I cannot believe there are any reasonable people in the United States who believe that transgender people shouldn't be protected, transgender students shouldn't be protected
from
sexual violence.
But that's not all that this addresses, isn't it? I mean, it does address participation. I mean, isn't that your hope? I mean, if that's all it addresses, not that violence isn't important, because clearly it is. But part of it is that the hope is that it actually addresses other matters as well.
Well, we do hope that the Department of Education issues guidance around specific instances where transgender students have to access programs, facilities, et cetera. But that's not what this did. This really was primarily about sexual assault and sexual violence. And then they said, and by the way, our reading of Title IX is that that protects transgender students as well, which, of course, means that we have reason to hope that they might do guidance that's more specific to other situations.
Isn't that one of your few criticisms, is that it's too vague? Is that you would like it to be more specific in addressing some of these other areas?
Right. We think it's really in the schools. It's to the school's advantage. It's to parents and students' advantage for everybody to understand their rights and responsibilities. So we would like to see clarification in the form of guidance around transgender students more generally and in specific circumstances in schools.
Gail, you were talking about the fact that, obviously sometimes that's what the Constitution does. It balances interests.
Yes.
It balances one interest against another. Can I push you on this question of whether a student who is transgender should be, how that student should be treated when he or she comes to school? I mean, you're saying that student should not be able to participate in all the other programs that other students can participate in. And I also want to ask more about your sense that this actually is to the detriment of women who are born as women, who are traditionally thought of as women apart from being transgender. Why do you feel that this is damaging to their interests?
Well, first I want to respond to the point about sexual assault. And there are already many laws about sexual assault. So no one on my side of this issue would think that anybody should be sexually assaulted or discriminated against because of their being male, female, transgender, whatever. And if we feel like that people are not being adequately protected in terms of sexual assault, then we need to empower the police to have more prosecutorial investigatory power. And we also need to increase the punishment for sexual assault. There are ways that can be done that don't implicate throwing open the locker rooms, throwing open the bathrooms, and denying women the opportunity for full participation, which is what Title IX was intended to protect in the first place. So you take a women's soccer team, you have 35 women on the soccer team. They have a right to privacy, a constitutionally protected right to privacy. And then you have one transgender student who wants to participate on the soccer team. You have a greater risk of injury if you allow the transgender person to participate on the soccer team. You're denying a woman a spot on the team, possibly, which is what Title IX is intended to do. And most importantly, no one has a constitutional right to uninjured feelings. So when you're balancing the constitutional right to privacy versus a non-constitutional right to non-injure feelings, the constitutional right should trump the non-constitutional right.
Maura, I'm going to give you a minute, final thought here.
There's no reason in the world to think that transgender people are going to injure people. I don't even know where that came from. But NCAA has really good rules now and have for quite a few years on transgender participation in sports. This isn't about people getting to decide who's men and women. And that's part of what Gail's trying to say, is that she knows who women are, and transgender people aren't either men or women. And that's wrong, and it's unfair, and it's unscientific, and it's illegal.
Final thought?
The point about the risk of injury, I think Maura took the wrong way. I didn't mean that they would be combative. I mean, there are physical differences between men and women. And even if you've had hormone therapy or other types of procedures, you're just generally, on a statistical average, going to be taller with...
Yeah, but there are really tall women who are born biological women, and there are really small men who are born biological men.
I mean,
I was at the dinner the other night, and I saw the, you know, Super Bowl winning quarterback who is smaller than I am.
You have to look at the averages. And for women to go to participation, I think this is a really important point. Before Title IX was passed, if you looked at the high school participation of male athletes versus female athletes, it was about 3.3 million male athletes participated in high school sports. And in 1971, less than 300,000 women participated. We've seen almost 1,000% increase on female athletes who participate in high school athletics now. I don't want to see us rolling in the other direction.
Gail Trotter is an attorney. She's a columnist and a senior fellow at the Independent Women's Forum. That's a conservative-leaning policy and research group. Maura Kiessling is executive director of the National Center for Transgender Equality. They were both here with us in Washington, D.C. once again, and I thank you both again for speaking with us.
Thank you.
Just ahead, there's been a lot of news about Bitcoin lately, including some new guidance from the IRS. So is it time to smash open the piggy bank and get that coin digital or not? It's our Bitcoin Primer, and that's next on Tell Me More from NPR News. I'm Michelle Martin.
Next time on The World...
No, 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 no.
A music video is making the rounds in Scotland. It features a Lady Gaga knockoff who sings about voting no on Scottish independence.
I'm just trying to poke fun at how I just think some of the arguments against independence are so ludicrous.
The woman behind Scotland's Lady Alba, next time on The World.
Weekday afternoons at 3 on AM 580.
Today's broadcast is made possible in part by the Friends of WILL and with support from Lincoln Square in Urbana, a lifestyle center which includes unique and independently owned specialty shops like the Art Co-op, Brownfield Sports, So Sassy, Wind, Water & Light, and Your Nails.
I'm Michelle Martin, and this is Tell Me More from NPR News. Now I'd like to turn to matters of personal finance. It turns out that money is more than what you have in your pocket. Today we want to take a look at the digital currency known as Bitcoin. Digital currency has been around since 2009, but there are signs that it could be gaining broader acceptance in the marketplace. For example, there's an MIT project in the works to give each undergraduate student $100 of Bitcoin in the fall. So we wondered if Bitcoin is where the smart money is now. Here to talk about that is Michael Casey. He is a columnist for The Wall Street Journal, and he's written extensively about Bitcoin and other digital currencies. Welcome. Thanks so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me, Michelle.
So I understand that you actually own some Bitcoin. How did you end up with this?
We talked about this beforehand, but I had to give a disclaimer as if I'm some sort of like big high-rolling investor in
exactly.
Bitcoin. Well, actually, I own about $40 worth. I bought $200 worth as part of a trip to Miami where there was a Bitcoin conference on, and I figured if I'm going to write about it, I should figure out how it works. Of course, I bought when it was at about $850. I think I bought a few hamburgers and maybe a drink or two with Bitcoin, and now it's all fallen down all the way down to $400. So not exactly one of my most successful investments, but hardly one that's going to really break the bank.
Well, that's a relief. I'm so glad to hear it, so we don't have to lend you some money to get back to the office. So first of all, what is it? I mean, is Bitcoin the only digital currency?
Well, no, it's not. It can be replicated fairly easily because it's an open source software. It's a program that can be reproduced. But what is it? I was calling it digital cash. It's digital cash for a digital age is the slogan some of us have fallen upon. The way to think about it is to focus on that word cash, because what cash is an absolute transfer of value between two people. When you walk over to somebody in the street and you say, here's $10, as you may do to a complete stranger, no one's going to have to step into the middle of that transaction and verify who either of you are and ensure that that money is truly worth what it is. You both recognize its value. We've never been able to figure out how to do that through the centuries, basically. And certainly when we got around to the electronic age, we had to do it through e-commerce. And so we layered on top of it all these banks and credit cards and payment processors and all these third-party institutions who had to verify the identity of the users and the creditworthiness of the various participants, all of which is extremely cumbersome and therefore very expensive and not necessarily visible. Of course, you do pay. You pay by way of higher prices for things. You pay by way of interest rates on credit. There's all sorts of ways in which the economy as a whole is burdened by the very expensive and cumbersome process of shifting money around the world. Bitcoin is not necessarily going to be the answer. It has enormous flaws and all sorts of risks associated with it, but it goes to the heart of this particular problem. And the great promise is that it will liberate money. And that is profound because there are all sorts of people around the world who do not have access to the same financial infrastructure that you and I have.
You mentioned earlier that your own adventure in Bitcoin has not always gone so smoothly, and that's been true of a lot of people. A major Bitcoin exchange, Mt. Gox, went bankrupt earlier this year. They said that they lost 750,000 consumer-owned Bitcoins. Only 200,000 have been recovered. Why do you think that is?
It's unregulated, and it's unregulated because no one quite knows what it is, right? So we have a very, I wouldn't say it antiquated, but we certainly have a regulatory framework that is out of touch with what this thing is. We really can't quite conceive of it from a legal perspective. So as a result, the various businesses that have built up around it are operating in ways that it's like the Wild West. You know, it's actually a kind of a lawless environment. So Mark Karpeles, the CEO, was also the CIO and the CFO and the compliance officer kind of rolled into one and was running this thing without any of the checks and balances that needed to be there. So that's why people are now talking about the next phase of Bitcoin, or let's say the next phase of digital currencies.
So finally, another big development, Bloomberg announced at the end of April that it will list Bitcoin prices on its data terminals. And as we mentioned, this idea at MIT to give the undergraduates, each of them, $100 in Bitcoin, because we assume that these students are early adopters and will kind of figure out interesting things to do with it. Do you see those as significant steps, or is that still kind of the, you know, where, say,
are we talking about our hovercrafts? So now,
exactly.
You know, are we
right.
talking about our Jetsons flying
exactly.
cars? Maybe, you know. But I think everything has to start somewhere. And these are important steps because it's all about being acknowledged and given legitimacy. The whole point about money is it needs to have trust associated with it. And trust is something that you earn. And you earn in our contemporary society through the recognition that comes from certain institutions. And in the world of Wall Street, Bloomberg is a very, very important institution because it's on every trader's desk. So if you have a price now being quoted on Bloomberg, although you could have just found that same price on the internet if you wanted to, it's now being given something of a stamp of approval. And that I think is significant. I mean, it doesn't sound like there's anything concrete there, and there isn't. But money is a fairly, you know, nebulous concept, but yet an extremely important one. And so the extent to which we build kind of communal and societal faith in whatever it is we're going to use as money, the greater it can arise as an institution.
Michael Casey is a columnist for The Wall Street Journal. He was kind enough to join us from our studios in New York City. Michael Casey, thank you.
Thank you, Michelle.
Now we go behind closed doors. That's the part of the program where we talk about issues that people often keep private. Our guest today is used to dealing with sensitive issues. Stephen Petro is an advice and etiquette columnist who's just moved his column from the New York Times to the Washington Post. For some time now in his columns, he's been helping readers navigate sticky situations, especially involving LGBT friends and relatives. Things like whether to be alarmed over a gay son's much older boyfriend or how seriously to take an older relative's anti-gay rants. But recently, Petro decided to let his readers help him deal with a secret he has held tight for 50 years. He'd been molested as a child. He recently told his story in a piece titled, "The Truth Is, Some Secrets Must Be Told." And Stephen Petro joins us now to tell us more.
Nice to be with you, Michelle.
What do you think made this the right time to write this now?
I was writing an essay about a cancer I had had a while ago, and I picked up a novel and was reading that concurrently, and there was a line in this novel that said from the protagonist, "If I can't ever tell anyone the true story, then no one will ever know me." And that line really kind of hung with me. And the reason it did was because I've talked about a lot of things in my life in other essays about having cancer, about my relationships, anxiety, but I had never talked about being molested. It had been a secret. I'd been in that closet. And it just seemed like it was time to dethrone that tyrant and see what happened.
How is it now talking about this with me? I mean, sometimes it's one thing to write something down, and I know that writing it down itself took some courage, but how is it talking about it?
Part of my impetus, probably a large part, was to raise my hand and to say I had been a victim of sexual molestation as a way to help others find their own voice. And it's been very gratifying and very painful to me to read the stories that have come my way. But I hope that the telling of my story will help others, especially will help men who I think have even more difficulty in some ways talking about these kinds of issues. And it's not a topic that is often talked about with men. So it's been a good week, Michelle.
For those who haven't read the piece yet, and I hope that people will, would you just briefly tell us what happened in as few or many words as you feel are appropriate? And I don't want to lead you where you don't want to go. So just tell me,
sure.
tell me what you feel like telling me about what happened.
And the story is really about the process of coming out about this and telling my story, less so about what actually happened when I was 8. Mm-hmm. And I think that the reason I did it this way was everyone who is going down this path, you know, has their own road. And I wanted to set a little bit of a roadmap and also show some of the blocks that I had along the way. It was very early on, maybe when I was 32, that I told a close friend of mine this news, and she confided in me that she had had a similar experience. And we were the only two who knew each other's secret. And then, for reasons not related to this, she committed suicide. And so I was alone. And then after that, I told a lover who betrayed me by trying to blackmail me into getting back with him with this secret and threatening to tell my entire family. And actually, Michelle, he sent a postcard to my office calling for a meeting of sexual abuse survivors at my apartment in the West Village in New York. So I definitely had some road bumps along the way. But at the same time after that, I started talking to some close friends who it turned out I could trust, to others who had been molested and going to therapy. And all of these things eventually helped me to get to the point where I was ready to talk about what happened, what my grandfather did to me when I was 8 years old.
You know, I have to say, and I think that some of the people listening to our conversation, particularly people who know your work, will be so surprised by this because they know you as a person who is willing to share things about your personal life when you think that they will be helpful, but also a person who has advocated for other people and has been very comforting to other people when things like this have happened to them. And you've said to other people, you know, friends, readers, you know, listeners, to say, look, you have nothing to be ashamed of. Let it go. Get the help that you need to make it right. And you even talk about having sought professional help, but you couldn't even bring yourself to tell your therapist what happened. And I just have to ask, why do you think that is?
I had so much shame, to be honest. And even going to a therapist and sitting in that chair, you know, one of the first questions they always ask is, why are you here? You've picked up the phone, you're going to pay the money. And I went to several sessions where I just wasn't able to say the words. So I had to write the doctor a note that I then read during that session. And that opened the door for me and allowed me to sort of get over the big bump.
Now, I have to ask a difficult question. And the reason I'm asking is I'm feeling that other people are probably having this question themselves. Mm-hmm. There are people who draw a direct line between being molested and being gay. They think either you were molested because you were gay or that you are gay because you were molested. Mm-hmm. And I have to ask whether you think that concern about that thought process is part of what kept this hidden.
I appreciate the question, first of all. And I guess let me try to answer it this way. When this happened, I was 8 years old. I was a little boy. I was a non-sexual little boy who was a towhead and could barely write in cursive. I don't think what happened had anything to do with my sexual orientation. I think that pedophilia is a very, well, I know that pedophilia is a very different, it's a mental condition. Homosexuality is no longer a mental condition as it was actually back in that day. And that it's not a choice. It's not a result of what happens to you. It's who you are. I was born that way, the gay way. But I understand that there's confusion, and sometimes people mistakenly make the link between a pedophile, like my grandfather, and gay folks, and they're really very different, as I know you know.
But that's my question, is that you think that's part of the shame factor. I mean, one of the things you wrote about in your piece is that you had a friend who, and you didn't identify who molested her, but we know for a fact that women can be molested by other women, and we know that young boys as young as you were, have also been molested by older women, right? So it's not necessarily a same-sex phenomenon, but I know that there are people who think that it is. And so it just makes me wonder whether part of the shame factor in keeping this hidden is that because you're a public figure, in part, you don't want to play into a narrative that you know some people have and feel it's almost like a loyalty piece. Do you see what I'm asking? You think that's part of it?
I do. And, it's interesting. My friend Julie, who did take her own life, she had been molested by her grandmother at an early age, and she was quite heterosexual through her life. I did want to go back to something else that you brought up, which was for years I have been putting myself in my stories and often trying to use my life history as a bridge in my work. And that's why I've written about having had cancer. That's why I've written about having an anxiety disorder. I had never brought this into any story because of the shame and because I wasn't ready, because I was afraid. And I have to say, I think I was probably more afraid than I was shamed as time went on.
What do you think you were most afraid of?
I think, Michelle, that what I was afraid of was that people wouldn't love me. And that came from a place of not being able to fully love myself while I lived in that dark place. You know, in the story, I talk about a dream. And in the dream, I'm in a classroom. I'm about the same age I was at the time. And my grandfather comes into the classroom and is looking for me. And I go with him without saying anything. And then he's looking for another, quote-unquote victim who is my friend. You know how people wind up in your dreams. My friend Charlotte, all of a sudden she's in my dream, and she says to him, no, I'm not going to go with you. And so there was the shame in that. But it was interesting when Charlotte read that, she said, you know, in our dreams, each character is a manifestation of the dreamer. And that was really another you saying no, which was very comforting to me in a way that I had never looked at that story or that dream. And I had worried about that dream a lot over the years.
Is there something that the people who love you could have done differently to make this easier for you so that you didn't have to carry this around so long by yourself?
Looking back, yes, I wish I might have been able to do this earlier, but that's not a fruitful conversation for me. I'm glad that I'm at this point in my, you know, in my journey, and looking forward to, you know, the road ahead, where I'm hoping that this secret will dissolve and continue to dissolve by putting the light on it, by talking about it, by not living in this dark closet any longer.
Stephen Petro is an etiquette columnist. He focuses on LGBT issues in his column Civilities for The Washington Post. He's the author of several books, including Stephen Petro's Complete Gay and Lesbian Manners. The piece that we are talking about ran in The Washington Post on the Tuesday, April 29th editions, but it is available now online. And he was kind enough to join us from Chapel Hill, North Carolina. Stephen Petro, thank you so much for speaking with us. Thank you for writing this piece.
Thank you, Michelle.
Coming up, what's on your wish list this Mother's Day? Flowers, a handmade card, breakfast in bed. We are going to celebrate foster mothers today and tell you why their big day can be a complicated one for them and their children. More from our parenting panel. That's ahead on Tell Me More from NPR News. I'm Michelle Martin.
Support for NPR comes from NPR member stations and from the Pajamagram Company, offering women's pajamas in gift packaging delivered overnight and for Mother's Day at pajamagram.com. From the William and Flora Hewlett Foundation, helping people build measurably better lives, on the web at hewlett.org. From the Ford Foundation, working with visionaries on the front lines of social change worldwide, at fordfoundation.org. And from Joyce V. Hale, in the interest of engaging an informed and civil electorate. This is NPR.
Just a few days remain to get a ticket to see Garrison Keillor live and in person this Wednesday, May 7th at 11:30 a.m. A limited number of tickets are left for this special event at Frasca Field in Urbana. Garrison, host of A Prairie Home Companion, will read from his new book, The Keillor Reader, and copies will be available for him to sign. Tickets available with a $50 donation include lunch. Get yours today at WILL.illinois.edu or by calling 800-898-1065.
Go in peace.
It wasn't until after he was nearly killed by a terrorist bomb on a train in Peru that Sam Baker started writing songs. Some are about the attack, some are character songs, others are like hymns. His fourth album is called Say Grace. Sam Baker on the next Fresh Air.
Weekdays at 11 a.m. and 7 p.m. on AM 580.
Today's programming is made possible in part by the Friends of WILL and by Krannert Center for the Performing Arts, inviting you to experience sustainable specials and everyday indulgences at Intermezzo Cafe. More information about upcoming events is on KrannertCenter.com.
I'm I'm Michelle Martin, and this is Tell Me More from NPR News. They say it takes a village to raise a child, but maybe you just need a few moms and dads in your corner. Every week, we check in with a diverse group of parents for their common sense and savvy advice. Well, Mother's Day is this Sunday, and if nobody else told you, we just did, so no excuses on the card, okay? On this day, we often try to lift up the contributions of mothers who come to motherhood through different paths. So today, we thought it would be a good time to hear more about and from foster mothers. So we called Jeannie Pritzker. She is the founder of Foster Care Counts, a mom of six and an unofficial foster mom to two. Welcome to the program. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
Also joining us, Chris Beam. She's the author of To the End of June, The Intimate Life of American Foster Care. And she's also a foster mom of one. Chris, thank you so much for joining us as well.
Thanks for having me.
So, Jeannie, I'm going to give credit where credit is due. We actually got the idea for this segment because we heard of your work. You have an annual day where you celebrate foster mothers. What made you want to be a foster mom, if you don't mind my asking? And why do you feel that foster moms and dads, although we're focusing on moms today, need more recognition?
I feel like they need more recognition because from my own personal experience, when I had my first Foster Mother's Day, 6 or 7 years ago and got to meet many foster mothers, I realized that they were maybe the role models that I have been looking for a very long time. And I realized I wanted to be more like them. And then I realized I wanted to do whatever I could to help them. And especially if I wasn't going to be a foster parent myself at the moment, I could support other foster parents doing what they are giving their lives to do.
Chris, you know, it seems as though we have like two competing stereotypes about foster parents and contradictory ones, as we often do about stereotypes. One is that they are either saints or villains, you know, saints, just, oh, selfless, just, you know, just laying down their lives for these kids, and villains, oh, my God, just in it for the money, you know, that kind of thing. Now, you've done a deep look at the subject. Why do most people become foster parents, and why did you want to become
one? You know, it's really interesting. We have a ton of research on foster kids. We know all their demographics. We know why they came into care. We know where they come from, what they look like, what they suffered. And we know virtually nothing about the foster parents from a national perspective. We only have a handful of studies. Most of the studies are very old, and they're mostly anecdotal. So really, we don't know a whole lot about the foster parents from a national demographic kind of picture. We know there's only been one study that looks at 1% of the foster parents, and we know that on average they're a little bit older than the general caregiving population. They're a little bit less moneyed than the general population, and they generally give a little bit less attention. But again, it's pretty anecdotal.
And why did you want to become a foster mom?
I didn't. It was a total accident. It was completely unplanned. My daughter was a kid in my – I was teaching high school at the time, and she was a kid in my class. And she had been in care since she was seven, and she's transgender. And, you know, they don't do a very good job of serving trans kids. And she got kicked out of my school, and she got sent to a probation school. And nobody knew her status there except for the administrators. And one of the administrators told a guard. And the guard told some of the kids, and they threatened to kill her. So she ran from that school, and that was a violation of her probation. So they threw her out of her group home, at which point it was deemed that she had broken the law, even though it was a violation of her safety, and this kind of thing happens all the time. So, you know, her probation officer called me up and said, "Do you want to take her?" You know, and here I am, a gay person, thinking I had escaped the fate of an unplanned pregnancy, and suddenly I had a teenager on my hands, and that's how it happened.
How's she doing?
She's great. She's an adult now, and she's fantastic. But, you know, what they told me at the time was, well, she's almost 18. She'll be out of your hair in 6 months. And
that's a nice way to look at a kid, isn't it? That's a great –
that's very common.
What is that?
And that wasn't true at all. I mean, she was 17, but she was emotionally maybe 12. I mean, she'd been through so much trauma. So she needed a lot more help and support, and so did I. And I agree with the other guests that foster parents can be amazing. But I think that the reason that we have this sort of polarized view of saints or demons is that kids often feel like parents are in it for the money because they're sometimes trained not to attach. So kids think, why don't these people love me? Why don't they like me? Why are they acting like this? They must be doing it for the money. So it sort of becomes code.
You know, it's interesting, though, because we started this conversation by talking about Mother's Day, and we reached out on Facebook because we wanted to hear from other, you know, moms and kids and some of the experiences that they've been having. A number of people wanted to tell us specifically that Mother's Day is tough for their family. So I'm just going to play a short clip from Shelley Academy, who is in Tulsa, Oklahoma, and who is a mom of three.
It's tough for the kids because they're always looking for that acceptance from their biological mother. And so I don't look forward to Mother's Day. I try to make it as comfortable for my kids as I can. But usually it involves at least one meltdown, and we're fortunate if we don't have to call the police on days like Mother's Day.
We heard a number of stories like this, and I just, Jeannie, do you want to take that one? Why do you think that is?
Yeah. Well, I think it's like any other occasion or event that has so much expectation attached to it that if and so much media explanation of what it should be like that it when if and when it doesn't turn out that way, it could be extremely disappointing. And that is, frankly, one of the reasons why we created Foster Mother's Day and why we hope that eventually Foster Mother's Day will be all over the country so that on this day, rather than being a day for kids and parents to dread, it could be the day that they really look forward to because it's the most wonderful day of the year for them.
You were also telling us, Jeannie, that that's the, that that in a number of the mothers who come or the families that come to your event, that's the many of them have told you that's the only appreciation that they ever get.
Yeah, and the best day of their year. Yeah. And that's where I got that from, straight from them. For a lot of those people, the event that we create, and I think it's the best day for a lot of people. We usually have around 300 volunteers, and for them, some of them, it's the best day of their year, too, because we just put together people who want to help and people who want to be celebrated with the most amount of fun, joy, excitement, laughter, sharing, shopping, exchanging, entertaining ever.
If you're just joining us, I'm sorry, let me just jump in to say, if you have just tuned in, we're having our weekly parenting conversation in advance of Mother's Day. We are talking about the experience of being a foster mom with Jeannie Pritzker of Foster Care Counts and Chris Beam, author of To the End of June. Chris?
Yeah, no, I think that Jeannie's idea of having a Foster Mother Day is really, really smart because I think in many ways foster care is set up as this sort of either-or paradigm. I mean, kids have case goals, and it's always either you're going to go home to your biological parent or you're going to be adopted. And even if a judge has terminated a parent's rights on paper and a child has been adopted by a foster parent, it doesn't mean that the parent's rights have been terminated in the kid's hearts. So it can be really confusing for a child when there's Mother's Day and the child is supposed to celebrate their, quote, new mom. Mm. That's still the child is still really is still really attached, and it's a complicated holiday, and they need sometimes a new way to think about this other parent. I mean, with my daughter, for example, she never wanted to be adopted, even though her mother's rights had been terminated. And people always ask, you know, why didn't you adopt her? Don't you want to adopt her? And yes, of course I do, but I never want to push that pain on her because for her, that symbolizes giving up hope, you know, that her mother will ever change.
You know, to the point that you made earlier, Chris, about the very polarized opinions, that's exactly what we heard on our Facebook page. We heard some very painful stories about foster kids who had been fostered, and one wrote in to tell us that that foster moms are not always the angels people make them out to be.
Right.
And this person specifically did not want to post publicly because she said people are so happy clappy about fosters and saying, I was removed from the home several times. I say foster whatever because there is no way on God's earth I would ever call any of these women mom. And
right.
Some very negative experiences. But on the other hand, I want to play a comment from Dawn Bolton from Trumbull, Connecticut about her foster mother, Lynn.
Lynn was able to be my mom. You know, she was able to be that shoulder to cry on, and she continues to be that person today. I have since become a teacher, wife, and mother. Lynn has shared each of these milestones with me. She cried at my wedding and held my son at his birth. I feel so lucky she opened her home and her heart to me and put up with all of my teenage angst before I finally flew the nest.
And you can hear, you know, the emotion in her voice, you know, all these years later. So we have about a minute and a half left. I'd love to hear a final comment, you know, from each of you. Jeannie, do you want to start?
Well, I think that for everybody out there who is not a foster parent but loves kids and feels an obligation toward making sure that any child in our country gets the best opportunity that they can given their circumstances, there's so many things that we can all do individually, little things, medium things, large things, to help these kids move along their journey. On our website, which is www.fostercarecounts.org, we have ideas of ways people can get involved in on all levels, okay. From being a mentor to buying a computer to sending a gift certificate to from one to the next. So anybody who wants to make a difference can definitely do so, and I would encourage it.
Chris, final thought from you has to be brief, I'm afraid.
I think that foster care is not a static thing. We tend to think of it as a broken system, and yet it's changing all the time. And I would encourage people to learn more about it. It's always changing.
Chris Beam is the author, forgive me, is the author of To the End of June, The Intimate Life of American Foster Care, a critically acclaimed work. She's a foster mom of one, and she was kind enough to join us from NPR New York. Jeannie Pritzker is founder of Foster Care Counts, a mom of six, and she's also fostered two children, with us from NPR West, which is in Culver City, California. Thank you both so much, and happy Mother's Day to you both.
Thank you. Thanks.
Finally today, we're switching gears now. You know that terrible feeling you get when you tell a joke that bombs? You think you're saying something hilarious or edgy or clever, and crickets or gasps or worse, thousands of people lighting up Twitter to say just how unfunny or messed up you are. Okay, so that last thing doesn't happen to most of us, but it did happen to Saturday Night Live writer Leslie Jones after her first on-air appearance on the show this weekend, where she delivered a riff on what she said was her sad dating life. It featured a bit on how much better off she'd have been during slavery. Here's a clip.
See, I'm single right now, but back in the slave days, I would have never been single. I'm 6 feet tall and I'm strong, Colin, strong! I mean, look at me, I'm a mandingo!
Well, a lot of fans were looking, but they weren't laughing. Jones was slammed across social media, and this happened just months after her hiring and that of two other African-American women that was hailed as a big step forward for the show. So we've been following this whole Saturday Night Live issue since it erupted, and so we wanted to call NPR television critic Eric Deggans to get his take on this latest Saturday Night Live controversy. Eric, welcome back. Thanks for joining us.
Glad to be here.
So a number of commentators jumped all over this, calling it appalling, disturbing, offensive, some other things that we can't say on this program.
Impolite company.
Impolite company, right. What did you make of it?
I thought this was a missed opportunity, to be honest. I think the heart of the piece was a great idea, which is that our standards of beauty in America are so tough on black women who are not thin and picture perfect that it might feel like you'd be better off in slavery times. And I could see a stand-up comic delivering a bit like that and killing in a room. But I think part of it was that the tone of the piece was wrong. It felt like she was pandering a little to the white viewers of the show. And I think it might have gone over differently if she had been in a context where she was facing a black audience, maybe. And a lot of her delivery sort of harkened back to these stereotypes that we have about black comedians with bug eyes and sort of ways of presenting yourself that are stereotypical. So I think you put all that together, an awful tone and this weird delivery, and you wind up with something that offends a lot of people.
She defended herself vigorously on Twitter, and she said that black people are too sensitive about slavery. She also asked whether a male comedian like Chris Rock or Dave Chappelle would get the same grief. In fact, Chris Rock actually did do a riff on that same topic some years ago, saying that, you know, part of the reason that, you know, that African Americans or black folks dominate professional sports is because of slavery. And she says that, and, you know, commentator Kelly Goff, who was also appeared on this program a number of times, posted a piece on The Root today saying that, making the same point. What do you make of that argument?
Well, again, what I say is it's all in the tone and it's all in the delivery and it's all in how you perceive where that perspective is coming from. If it feels like you're offering, I mean, you know, what Chris Rock said, you know, a white sports commentator got fired for saying that. So it is all in sort of how you deliver it and how the context is. I think even people who want to say, I mean, I wanted to hold off on jumping on Leslie Jones about this because I feel like Saturday Night Live is still struggling to figure out how to deal with and make fun of some of these racially charged topics. So they're going to make mistakes. They're going to put stuff on that's maybe not as funny as you would like. What I hope is that people don't get too upset and that the show learns to listen to its viewers, because so many people got upset about this, that it's obvious that it wasn't the best way to present this idea and they should have done a better job. And somebody who was editing this stuff should have told her how it was going to play, because it was obvious to me when I saw it that it was going to be a firestorm.
You know, I just do not want to advance this argument that people shouldn't express themselves because somebody, you know, A, might be offended, or B, that would silence everybody from that group because somebody is offended by the thing that one person says. However, having said that, given, as you said, there's been so much sensitivity and kind of controversy in politics around the casting and the writers at this particular show and more broadly television in general, what do you think about the obviously too soon to sort of determine, but this controversy, do you think it could be an upside in the sense that it makes people kind of listen more carefully, or a downside in the sense that people are saying, you know what, I don't know, this all this diversity stuff is too much trouble?
Well, there's always a danger that people are going to say it's too much trouble. But the bottom line is this stuff is going to happen. And when you're pushing the boundaries of how you talk about gender and race in a comedic context, sometimes this stuff is going to happen. I always say you got to earn that. You know, these topics are so important to people. And one of the ways you subjugate people in a society is you make stereotypes about them acceptable and funny and alluring and attractive. So we do have to be careful about how our comedy talks about people of color and people who don't have power in this society. That's a conversation that comedians have to accept. They're going to push the boundaries and then we're going to talk about what they said. And both of us have to be willing to allow that. To get the best comedy, you got to push the boundaries a little bit. And then when you push the boundaries and people say you crossed the line, you got to be willing to hear that.
Eric Dagans is NPR's TV critic. He was kind enough to join us from his home office in St. Petersburg, Florida. Eric, thanks so much for joining us.
Always fun to be here.
And that's our program for today. I'm Michelle Martin, and this is Tell Me More from NPR News. Let's talk more tomorrow.